Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. The Rules of Investing gets inside the minds of leading investors, economists, and industry experts, and it's brought to you by Livewire Markets. Today's guest is Junbei Liu, lead portfolio manager of the Tribeca Alpha Plus Fund. Junbei has been with Tribeca for 15 years, starting out as an equities analyst before rising to portfolio manager. In 2018, at the Sohn Hearts and Minds Conference, she beat all 15 other fund managers to take the top spot with a 120% return on her stock pick. In this episode, we discuss the reopening trade and how to get exposure to it. She explains why it's time to get domestic exposure over global. And she shares a high-quality company that's been recently added to the portfolio at a very attractive price. If you're an Apple Podcasts or Spotify user, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so that you don't miss an episode. Or if you're a Livewire subscriber, hit the follow button at the bottom of this wire to be notified whenever I post content. Not a Livewire subscriber yet? Just head on over to livewiremarkets.com. It's free, easy to register, and you'll get access to insights from the leading investment minds in the country. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Hi, Junbei. Welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Hi, Patrick. It's always great to speak with you.
It sure is. It's been, I just looked it up before, and it's been 2 years since we had you on the show last. We had you on when we were doing Future Generation back in 2018. So it'll be great to get some current thoughts from you, see how you're thinking about markets today. It's definitely been certainly a lot has changed in the last 2 years. In fact, even a lot has changed in the week or so since I wrote the questions for our chat today. So it'll be interesting to see how things are standing for you today.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I said things certainly has changed a lot from 2 years ago. I think what's incredible in the last 12 months for everyone is not just people in the financial market, but for everyone is that none of us really expected to live through any pandemic. You know, last one we heard was, probably the Spanish flu, and none of us pretty much experienced it. And, you know, for us to go through that experience together globally at the same time being also in the financial market, it's just been an incredible experience. And also, I think, you know, there's a couple of themes that's coming out of it as well. Really, I think will change the way we live and for the better, of course. And it just, you know, to be in the financial markets, we are really at the forefront of a lot of those changes, which has been quite exciting.
Yes, most of us had never, wouldn't have even known what an epidemiologist did at the start of the year. Now we're all experts on pandemics.
That's right, the curve.
but it has been an interesting learning experience for us all. But I want to talk to start by talking a little bit about you, get to know you a little bit. So I'm curious, how did you first kind of develop an interest in investing? Was it something, you know, that happened earlier in life for you or post school? What was it that first sparked the interest?
Look, I've always studied, have a good interest across economics. So I study economics and finance in school and through university. I've always find it interesting when, you know, when people study about, you know, how people can be incentivized on different levels, how certain preference can be shaped. And then you move on to look at the return allocation and the like. But it is that incentive side that always looks really interesting to me. And I was fortunate straight out of uni, I started working for a group called Aspect Huntley, and you know, I was writing newsletters for retail investors, and Huntley newsletters in the early 2000s were very famous across retail investor base, and you know, we wrote about small caps, wrote about large caps, yield. It was an incredible learning experience, and that really, you know, helped me and shaped, you know, my investing philosophy. And then I think I developed sort of interest in, you know, once you get your investment thesis right, often it can be against the mainstream, so against a lot of other people's view, because market sentiment can shift from time to time, and, you know, and a lot of time markets can be wrong. And then if you get that particular story right, get the business right, do your research, it is incredibly rewarding. Yeah, so I had a couple of those really interesting, you know, convictions and stock recommendations, and it just has been incredibly exciting. So I guess, yeah, that's sort of helped me to progress along that path. And I guess, you know, the really also fortunate thing is that every day we come across so many extremely talented people, you know, very driven, very talented executives, senior executives that, you know, run some of those most innovative businesses. And it's just been learning curve for almost every day for me. And then, you know, I just love this industry where you never stop learning. Every single day there's new businesses we get to learn about, and they can be so diverse, so innovative. And I think look forward the next 5-10 years, ASX leadership or sector will really change, and quite a big part of it will be dominated rather than the old industry sectors. It will actually be a lot of innovative sectors. So that's very, very exciting for investors like myself.
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, the financial rewards are obviously what most people tend to focus on with investing, but I can certainly identify with you there. The intellectual rewards that you get from, you know, from finding an idea and researching it, and, you know, having the conviction to put some of your own money on the line and then seeing it play out, is, there's nothing else quite like it, I don't think.
Absolutely. I think we, at the moment, what's interesting is that we're at this, I would call it not so much crossover, it's almost an inflection point. It's been some time now. It's been quite a few years now, but this inflection point of adoption of technology or innovative businesses, right, or a lot of technology path, you know, this pandemic has really structurally shift or pull forward some of those adoption. And in my view, that to learn about the future, what the future might look like from some of those businesses is incredibly exciting. And also at this point, because ASX is still dominated by a lot of, you know, the traditional, like the industrials or the banks and the others. So investors' base has yet to really understand how to value or capture or really understand those businesses, the innovative businesses. They are so new for most of the investor base. And in my view, this represents incredible opportunity by really learn to, you know, learn more about those business and, you know, come up with more innovative way or more structural way of viewing those businesses rather than the near-term earning, which, you know, everyone looks at for the traditional businesses. So it's a very exciting time.
How do you actually go about putting a value on those types of high growth stocks, the kind of companies you're talking about there? You know, people often criticize, you know, obviously the poster child is Afterpay, and people often criticize it for being overpriced. You know, it's on 100 times earnings, or in some cases, some of these stocks don't even have positive earnings. How, you know, a lot of the focus goes on PE ratios, even if they're looking a couple of years ahead, sometimes those can still make it look very expensive. So how do you go about putting a valuation on those kinds of high growth stocks?
Absolutely. Look, but first let me state, the most important thing to remember is that for a lot of those high growth, especially innovators of those new sector, most of them fail. You know, there's no doubt about it. Most of them won't make it, but there will be one or two will be the true innovator and leader of those sector, and they will be dominating, you know, the growth going forward. So when we look at some of those really high growth businesses at their early stage, you know, when they're still at their infancy, you know, we take interest in them, we follow them. We follow them for many years before we even look into invest. And what this does is that it helps us to understand the management, understand the strategy, understand how they execute, and understand the execution record. So, you know, for especially those early stage businesses, you know, when they're still at their infancy, you know, most of the valuation that that you pay, almost a share price valuation, is pretty much linked to what the future might look like, the current addressable market, and where they might get to. This is how normally people will look at those business. And if they don't execute, then that addressable market or future expectation can fall dramatically. So it's incredibly important to really follow at every step of the way to make sure that this business, it's real and it will, you know, it is real. It's executing. It's got a lot of demand for its product. It has invented or created a new sector, and it's creating a lot of attraction from institution, from customer base, from everywhere. So these are some of the milestones we do want to tick off. And at the same time, we want to see them to be able to replicate those business model in other markets, because Australia is not enormous. Australia has been incredibly innovative when you think about it, some of our highest growth businesses that have gone global. So it's important to see those business to be able to take the existing successful business model and replicate offshore. Not many have succeeded, but we have had a lot of success story, you know, over the years. The biggest will be, you know, CSL, currently probably still the largest company in the ASX. But look at that company. That's come a long way from a pure domestic to global, now dominating global space. So, so that's how we look at those business. Incredibly important at early stage, follow them, make sure they're executing. Then we build our positions. But of course, you know, every now and then things go wrong in a business, that particularly sometimes it's the things that business can't control, or the management not within their control. It's important as investors to understand how management respond, because nobody can tell what future might look like. But we need to have, if we have a proper plan, we have a better framework, we know how to respond, and that really defines how successful they will be in the future. And then we build our position through those periods, and then see them opening up into new markets, and then the valuation will grow from here. So that's how we look at it. We don't just go jump into a stock that is really expensive without knowing deeply what those businesses are.
How much of a factor do you think momentum has been for achieving good investment performance in equities in the last few years?
Look, when people talk to those factor return, the momentum and the like, you really need to look at, you know, earnings, right? So if a company keeps delivering earnings that is better than what market is expecting, that creates an earnings momentum. And then if you keep seeing analysts keep upgrading their earnings, that momentum become very, very strong. So business like that, as you would expect, share price perform very well, because ultimately over the long term, share price always follow earnings, especially if you keep delivering, not only delivering and outperform. It does become harder when company grow bigger, but that's why the earnings momentum is incredibly important, you know, for a company to do well. In terms of price momentum, I think on that front is it's a little bit harder to call, just because share price is going up. Is it going to go higher? I would just come straight back to the earnings. If the earnings are going higher, share price is going higher. So that's the main thing that investors should focus on. There's a lot of noise in the equity market, particularly today. Equity market has really changed in terms of its landscape and structure. There's a huge amount of money that is sitting in passive, which are those index following type of funds. And there's money sitting with a lot of systematic. So systematic as in, you know, quantitative funds. So a lot of these money will be swayed by whichever direction things go and noise. So for active investor, this is actually good environment for you to take longer term view. And because when a company share price fall because of sentiment, because changes in those other passive players, it's actually incredible opportunity to, you know, to buy into those business, and then you will see your return reasonably quickly because of the market structure today. So do the work, understand where the earnings are going rather than the share price, where the earnings going, and then the share price will follow. It works most of the time.
most of the time.
No, but actually, it actually works. Let me just correct that. It actually works a lot of time. Oh, not a lot of time. I don't want to say 100% of the time, because every now and then it might take years to come through. It depends on what sort of company it is. But knowing, you know, more than, let me put a probability, more than 90% of time, it will absolutely work. And, you know, and if you, the longer term view you take, the higher that probability is, just simply because the noise can last a little bit longer than expected. But in today's market, look, that noise actually moves pretty quickly.
This year, and even in recent years, there's been obviously a quite a noticeable boom in e-commerce companies and payments companies, which has been accelerated in 2020. This has obviously been not just in Australia, but overseas as well. What do you think will be the most important trends for investors to be watching in the years ahead?
Yeah, this is. I think this is a fantastic question. This is the point I actually alluded to earlier as well. This pandemic has really changed structurally, changed the way we live our lives. Not 100%, but it changed in the way that we demand convenience. You know, the reason for booming online e-commerce. Actually, we had e-commerce boom for many years, but you know, the pandemic has forced people to experiment with a lot of those e-commerce platforms. And then I think there will be a percentage of the population, and then there will be portion of the tasks from now on will be structurally shopped online. So on these basis that these companies, the boom those e-commerce company have experienced, is not going to be just one-off. So more recently, I think more like this week, you know, there was a bit of fear of, you know, with the vaccines here, with the reopening play, you know, people will structurally forget to, well, they won't shop online anymore, they'll be going to the shops. But don't forget, look at those e-commerce businesses just here in Australia. We pretty much, aside from Victoria, I'm sorry, Patrick, aside from Victoria, that, you know, most of the country has been reasonably open. If you look at what the property trust, so the shopping centres have said, most of the rent collections and shop has been open close to 90%. So, that's been open since late July, August. And yet when those e-commerce company reported their update in September, October, the number is still escalating in terms of growth. So, you know, people didn't just stop shopping online just because shops is out. You know, so that gives us a lot of confidence that this is not going away. I still believe those businesses will have a fantastic Christmas. And especially this week, this is actually a great time to talk about those business. We're heading into, yesterday was a Singles Day sale. Now we got Black Friday, this Friday, then we've got Cyber Monday. We've got a couple of those online sale, and it's the biggest online calendar, and it is increasingly becoming very important to retail calendar from, you know, it pulls a lot of spending from the offline normal traditional Christmas period into this online growth. And I expect this year's the digital sales period is going to deliver phenomenal growth. So yeah, so it's all very exciting period, but of course some of them have very hard, they're expensive, but look, you know, we in these company are going to experience multi-years of growth, you know, in terms of earnings is coming off very, very low base. Yeah, it's very exciting.
Yeah, anecdotally, it seemed as though there was a bit of interest in getting out to the shops on the first few days after retail opened back up. But ever since then, it seems like people are still doing the vast majority of their shopping online, even here. So it seems almost like the reverse of what we saw in March when we first went into lockdown, with, you know, the first little rush where people go in one direction and then they normalize a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. Look, I do feel sorry for you, Patrick, that you live in Melbourne. They're still kind of in opening up now. But in Sydney, when we first opened up completely, you know, absolutely there was a huge level of pent-up demand back into the shops. But I do know from a lot of personal experience that, you know, a lot of daily tasks and duty, for example, grocery shopping, you know, things that normally takes a lot of time on the weekends, for families are these days largely done online because of the convenience of it. And also at the same time, retailers have invested significantly because of the requirement, the very need of having the online offering because of the lockdown. Retailers actually provided those opportunities now for the shoppers to do online. And I think this is incredible. Incredible improvement, and I don't think that will go away at all. It was on the path to get there, but pandemic has pulled forward that progress and that shift. So these are the structural shifts that that is really taking place.
Yeah, I for one will never be going back to doing my grocery shopping in person. Given the strong performance that we've seen in Australia in terms of fighting off this virus. Obviously, it's a very different situation in Europe and America, though. They're facing some pretty significant challenges there, even after the announcement of the vaccine. Given this, would you prefer to be holding stocks with offshore exposure or those with exposure to the Australian economy?
Yeah, so the direct answer is definitely Australia. I think Australian equity is going to is in a pretty sweet spot relative to global. I think, you know, one is that we're a whole lot better in terms of caseload and how we're coming out of this pandemic. And then, you know, our businesses with domestically focused are actually looking pretty strong. We've got consumer confidence very strong, business confidence pretty good. People are paying back their loans. Our stimulus still in place, interest rate still low, and it'll be low for quite a long time. And then we have the housing market seems to picking up in terms of activity, in terms of price, in terms of listing. So our economy is actually looking pretty healthy. It looks really, really well on path to recover from the pandemic-induced recession. So I will absolutely put more money in domestically focused businesses. But at the same time, you do not want to completely disregard some of the business that has, you know, has a really strong market position in some of those offshore markets. Business such as James Hardie just reported its numbers recently, just a few days ago. It was just incredible business. You know, aside from an initial lockdown in the US had a bit of impact, and they went on, you know, cut the cost, hold the cost, reinvest, generate great cash flow, and yet still delivering phenomenal growth. You know, with the interest rate as low as it is, US housing market is doing very, very well. And James Hardie is growing above market. At the same time, reinvest and continue to be very innovative. So business like that, you don't want to, you know, it's a blue chip. So, you know, it should always be part of your portfolio given the tailwind it is experiencing.
When you were writing back in October, I think it would have been, you seemed a little bit reserved about how quick you thought the recovery would be, particularly, you know, locally and particularly in Victoria. Given Victoria's, I would say, unexpected success at driving the virus numbers down and with us now opening up, do you think the recovery could be quicker than you had previously thought?
I think my reservation was really about the changes of the market risk sentiment heading to the US election, because its US election was such a big event, and whichever way, you know, investors will take risk off, as in pull money out of the market. So when they do that, any negative sentiment, any negative news flow will drive this market down, which, you know, we did see that a couple of times. We saw that in September, we saw that a little bit in October, but then we saw the market was down, you know, I think was down close to 7% leading up to the US election. So that was our caution. And now that with the outcome of the US election, you know, that's one biggest risk removed. With a split government in the US, it seems that policy outcome will be reasonably benign. And on these basis, we are increasingly becoming very bullish the equity market. We think we have this clear runway, you know, to, as the economic activity pick up, particularly here in Australia, with our economy, we just talked to earlier, with our economy doing better and consumer better and everything. And at the same time, globally, markets are looking a bit more optimistic. Then, you know, we're really on track to deliver pretty strong return over the next 12 months.
Your portfolio looked as though it was positioned, I guess, towards what we'd call recovery stocks. You've mentioned a couple of them. Transurban was one that stood out to me, and away from, I guess, what we'd call the lockdown stocks, you know, stocks like Coles, exposed to that online delivery and the restocking of people's cupboards, Goodman Group, which got very popular during the lockdowns because of the industrial property angle. Mm. I'm curious, is that a conscious and a deliberate choice to try and get exposure towards those themes, or is that something that comes from the bottom up and is just a result of where the opportunities have taken you?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. We want to focus on the bottom-up stock story, understand where the opportunities are, but while at the same time, be conscious not to be completely skewing our portfolio. I always believe that a good portfolio is a well-diversified portfolio. You need to have bottom-up driven ideas across many different themes when people talk to. Because if you just play one theme, themes are the things that can be dangerous because, you know, market sentiment can shift. Today they want reopening, tomorrow they want stay-at-home basket. So, you know, I always believe I always have stocks across, or, you know, most of those themes to be well-balanced. So, you know, when we look at some of those ideas, we have been investors of Afterpay, which has benefited enormously from this, you know, from this shift to online and the e-commerce trade. And, you know, we'll continue to be a believer of this business. It's real and it's managed to continue to execute impeccably and continue to grow its end market. And so that has delivered a lot of return for us. But look, we continue to hold business like that. And at the same time, we were looking at opportunities. Just so when market sell-off happened in March and April, you know, we bought a lot of retailers. We bought Sydney Airport. We bought Qantas. We bought, you know, Ramsay Healthcare. We bought Transurban, because these are blue chip businesses. And, you know, and in a normal environment, you know, these businesses in normal environment with interest rate as low as it is, they would have done so much better in terms of share price. But in this case, because the lockdown has actually affected their earnings, they all went down. But we know it's a short and sharp recovery. So we took a slightly longer term view and we bought those businesses. And we know they will deliver phenomenal amount of return for us in the next few years. Actually, I haven't mentioned the shopping centers. Yes, you know, there will be a level of shoppers now start shopping online, but you will still return to the shops. And these businesses are trading at 50% discount to their net asset value. I'm talking about the Westfield shopping centers and the like. And now the rent collection is already back to above 90%, and with the country not completely free from lockdown yet. And so, you know, in our view, the 50% is too large a discount. And we know the share price will do very well once we move past, you know, the fear about the second wave and the third wave here in Australia. So we run that type of, sort of, if you call it the barbell strategy. And, you know, when you talk to Coles and groceries, we do like Woolworths a little bit better than Coles. We held Coles through that pandemic. It's done very well for us. We just felt that relative valuation and, you know, and also in terms of the earnings trajectory, we like Woolworths a lot better on this basis. We also think Metcash will be a beneficiary of this as well on the smaller end. But just overall, we feel that grocery sector, you know, is going to be the funding source for a lot of other great ideas, which will deliver a huge amount of return relative to those names.
You said recently that the volatility that we'd seen in the markets was giving you some outstanding opportunities to pick up quality companies at attractive prices, which is, of course, what we all love to see. I was wondering if maybe you could share one of these that you've added to your portfolio in recent months and tell us a bit about the opportunity and why you like it.
Well, there's one standout one that we recently added to portfolio, that is Treasury Wine. You know, this goes to show our our way of investing, you need to be a little bit contrarian and take longer term view. Look, there's a lot of fear about, you know, escalation in Chinese Australian sort of political tension, and of course, you know, as a result, there's quite a bit of export to China has been impacted by high tariff, and treasury wine, you know, wine has been one of the fastest growing export into China, obviously has been caught in that crossfire. And then there's speculation about high tariff to come through. We look at it, the share price has fallen more than 40% on the back of that news. You know, we looked at the share price, I think it went below $8 at one point. You know, we do believe at that price, majority of the share price was actually the value of the share price is pretty much underpinned by large part by those premium wine that is sitting in its cellar. Something like 70% of the share price value is sitting in that, and the rest is pretty much, you know, those premium farmland in Napa Valley and South Australia. So, you know, with that as the basis, we just felt there was so much value on offer, given the uncertainty. You know, we believe that Penfold has built incredible brand loyalty with the Chinese consumer and global consumer. It is highly sought after. You know, over the years, the company's has been growing more than, you know, more than 30%, you know, with its product into China. And this is driven by, that's per annum, and driven by volume and price. Some of its premium labels that has been growing significantly over the last, you know, two decades, but yet that's never really put any dent, you know, on in terms of the volume and then the demand. So I think the brand loyalty Chinese consumer has demonstrated towards its label is going to you know, continue to drive the sale into that channel, into that market. And so with the tariff that is coming, we know that it will come. I don't think that will have significant change, and those consumers will find ways to buy those premium labels. You know, any short-term disruption will really be, you know, pretty much short-term disruption. It will recover. And this is not to mention that trade tension is usually political trade tension. You know, we do hope that will ease. Looking at some of the other examples of trade conflict between China and their trading partners, and look, you know, their trade over the last three decades all being very consistently strong despite, you know, differences at times. So, you know, with all of that, we just felt there was so much value on display, and it's one of our new addition into our portfolio.
It sounds fascinating, buying their wine cellar and their land and getting the operating business for free by the sounds of it.
That's right. You're not paying for any brand loyalty, nor are you paying for any future demand for those wine. And don't forget, wine inventory are not like normal inventory. They, especially premium wine, they're appreciating assets. So, you know, if you look at the historical premium wine value, you know, the longer you store them, the more they appreciate. So it's incredibly important to differentiate that from other, you know, examples of inventory bills. So this, there's just so much value in this business.
Well, that's the main part of the interview done. But I've got three favourite questions that I like to ask every one of my guests. So we've got a few minutes left. We should have time to go through them. So I'm just going to jump into those now.
Okay.
Could you share something with us that you've read or watched or listened to recently that you thought was really interesting or which taught you something valuable?
Yeah, this is a really good question. So recently I've been reading this book by Dan Ariely. So the book is called Predictably Irrational. It's not a new book, but, you know, it's one of those fun readings. It explores the topic of behavioral economics or behavioral finance. He talked to that, you know, how easily and how irrational we are as people. You know, a lot of time we're in finance industry, you know, we look at the financial returns, we calculate all of that. We're all pretty confident that we are very rational and they're making very rational decisions and the like. But, you know, when you actually look at a lot of behavioral sides, our rationality or our perceived rationality is actually so much influenced by our behavioral biases, which we're not on top of because these are unconscious biases. He gave a lot of examples about, you know, how how much we can be influenced subtly by different things, and how irrational we are, and then hence the outcome, how irrational they can be. I think it's a fascinating read. It's a great read for any investor to try to understand our own biases and fear and greed, and in turn that, you know, hopefully help us to become better, you know, when making decisions, and just sort of be on top of our urges, you know, when we have that animal spirit, and a lot of that is not rational. That's a great book, and it's fascinating. Gives a lot of examples of how, you know, how we can be easily influenced. You know, all the marketers probably do that all the time in advertising. It clearly works. It's a great read. Great read for Christmas.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. I do love those behavioral economics books, and I haven't read that one yet, so I might have to add it to my summer reading list.
It's fascinating. So this guy, he does a lot of TED Talk, Dan Ariely. He is the one that made the famous statement about, you know, companies shouldn't pay their staff bonuses because it doesn't work. So you really have to read his book to understand why, and understand the incentive and how people can are influenced not just by money, monetary terms, but there are so many other drivers of our action. Yeah, let me not oversell it. It's great. Great reading.
Well, hopefully my boss isn't listening this far into the interview, and he didn't hear you say that they're not paying, they shouldn't pay bonuses.
That's right.
As always, I'll put a link up to that book in the Wire for this podcast. So to any of our listeners, if you just want to jump on livewiremarkets.com, go into the Wire for this podcast, which should be pretty close to the top of the feed if you're listening to this on a Saturday, and you can get a link to that. But if you don't want to jump on there, I'll just repeat the name for you. It's Predictably Irrational by Dan Ariely. I think that's how you pronounce it. I've never been quite sure how to pronounce his name.
I'm the same. I hope it's the right way.
If you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university and give your younger self a single piece of investing advice, what would it be?
That's a really good question. I think be confident. You know, we at the beginning of the career, one of the big thing is, you know, we lack confidence. And even though as a young analyst, you're just not sure if you know, especially if everyone else is different from you, you know, when you come up with, you know, an idea or after thorough research, but if everyone else is against you, then you kind of don't have enough confidence to push forward. So you just get influenced by everyone else's behavior, the fear and the like. I think the main thing is, one advice I would give is that, quite frankly, you know, it's most of people are full of biases, and, you know, quite a lot of good decisions are made when others are really fearful. So, yeah, so it's just be confident and back your own conviction would be the biggest advice. And, you know, I've experienced it over the years again and again that because of the fear of not, you know, against the mainstream, that might affect my final conviction. But I experienced it again and again that it turned out to be, I was absolutely right. And it's important to have enough confidence to back your own idea and conviction.
I've got one last question for you, but before I ask it, I always like to insert a little bit of a disclaimer. Don't try this at home. We're not actually suggesting to anybody that you go out there and put all of your money in a single stock and forget about it for 5 years. This is supposed to be a bit of an exercise in long-term thinking and hopefully a little bit of fun. So with that being said, if the markets were going to close for the next 5 years, starting from tomorrow, and you could only own shares in one company, what would it be?
Look at this. There's one business I would, you know, put my mother's money in and forget about it for 5 years, would be Cochlear, because you look, its stock is expensive and the like, but this is one business to have this structural growth driver, innovator of its sector, fast growing, and, you know, the rest of the world is still picking up in adoption. So this is one business in 5 years, you know, I cannot envisage any issues that, you know, that will shift that structural growth story. It's a blue chip business. Its shareholder base is incredibly loyal because they are very long-term investors and they understand the value proposition of business like that. So yeah, that is one where I would put my my parents' money in, and it's incredibly valuable business on the 5-10 long-term horizon.
Well, I love your spin on that, and in fact, I might even steal that for myself at some point in the future.
No problem.
Well, Junbei, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been great to hear from you again. Fascinating to get your insights into the markets and investing. I hope to speak to you again at some point in the future.
Oh, thank you so much for including me in this session. And hopefully next time won't be 2 years away. The world may well be very different by then.
I have no doubt it will be. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
All right, bye.
Well, that's the end of the show. If you made it this far, I hope that means you enjoyed it. So please follow us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Or if you're a Livewire reader, give this wire a like. Thanks for tuning in.